On today's episode of The Good Word with Goodwill, J.A. Adande joins us to talk about the war between Chris Paul and Scott Foster, the surprisingly fun in-season tournament, and of course, the Los Angeles Lakers. All that and much more on today's episode of The Good Word.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports, Ball Don't Lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, the host of this podcast, and we are part of the Ball Don't Lie Network. Get us wherever you get your podcast. Don't forget to rate us and review us. And we are also on YouTube. So if you are seeing us on YouTube, you see the man in the purple sweatshirt and the beard that was not present when he was working at ESPN. My man, J.A. Adande. J.A., he's now the director of sports journalism at Northwestern University, the Medill School of Journalism, where you were an alum. And I've had the pleasure of speaking there a couple of times. J.A., he was really scraping the bottom of the barrel there.
You got a purple hoodie to show for your time.
I do. I love that hoodie. That hoodie is quite cool. And when I used to walk around Chicago in the hoodie, people would ask me, "Oh, when did you attend Medill?" And I would have to be like, "I didn't."
but I spoke there.
I did. I spoke there, and the kids were. Everybody's all cool, and of course, you get the emails and stuff, and people actually treat you like you are a respected adult. When I've never felt like a respected adult at my youngish age, but Jay, of course, has all the experience from the Chicago Sun-Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, like everywhere, ESPN.com, all this stuff. So, Jay, we're gonna get right into it. Chris Paul and Scott Foster. It's a tale as old as time. Player and official not getting along. Now, I've heard what Chris Paul said after he got ejected. That will actually get you ejected. But what got him ejected, I'm not really sure. Like, there's clearly something personal. This is not a made-up Twitter beef. This is something that's real and tangible, and both parties feel it. And Jay, people have said, why do you have Scott Foster reffing games that Chris Paul is in? I don't know if that's an actual solution to it, but what's your take from, 30,000 feet from that?
I feel like he just can't referee the games there. But he's going to referee playoff games. He's going to referee NBA Finals games, right? So you might as well deal with the problem sooner rather than later. And if it's going to be in a regular season, if it's going to be contentious, so be it. Because if the team, the Warriors go where they want to go this season, then they're going to run into them sooner or later. So even later. So I feel like there should be more transparency. I really feel like that's been the solution for officiating for a while. Players and coaches are held accountable after every game to the media. They're forced to answer questions. The officials that take special circumstances.
Right.
Why not have them talk more frequently? Why not normalize them? But also, why not have them be held more accountable? I've mentioned this to people at the NBA frequently. They've always been reluctant or resistant to doing so. But part of the problem is we don't hear Scott Foster on this. And so he should be allowed to explain and we should hear an honest assessment from him. It would help if he wasn't just walled off and it's a one-sided discussion. We only hear Chris Paul's side of the story.
Yeah. And Chris Paul said some weird things where he said, it is personal. Like he admitted, he said it. It's personal. He mentioned that there has been a situation with his son, which that is really, really cryptic. And he mentioned a meeting with Doc Rivers when Doc Rivers was coaching the Clippers and Chris Paul's with the Clippers and Bob Delaney, who I believe at one point was the head of officiating. And it feels a certain way. And the numbers are the numbers. 3-17 in games Chris Paul has played in with Scott Foster as a ref. 1-13 in playoff games. Like, it speaks to something. And my thing is, it's both-sided. If Chris Paul knows that me and Scott Foster have issues and it's clearly personal, you've got to go out of your way to just avoid this dude. You can't antagonize him. And Chris Paul is the habitual verbal line stepper. He's going to say, "Hey, his shirt isn't tucked in," or "he stepped over the line on a free throw." Chris Paul is a cop. All right. And you can't police the police on the floor. That's not really going to work, especially when the cop don't like you. You're going to get caught doing 55 and a 54 because Scott Foster's the dude that's going to catch you doing that. And it seems like whether Chris Paul can't stay away from him or he feels like Scott Foster baits him, I feel like the onus, wherever Chris Paul is playing, it's got to be on him to sort of stay away from this.
And I think we did have precedent, like way back when, didn't Jake O'Donnell, wasn't he banned from officiating certain players? Remember that?
I remember that.
That was going way back when.
And yep.
Clyde Drexler, like someone that he had beef with, and they did take the step that he did not officiate that team. So there is some precedent, but it's going way, way back. It was really a different league at that point.
But this is nothing new. Like, I haven't been a beat writer but for so long, but having been around players, I know players who have problems with Danny Crawford. I know players who have problems with Joey Crawford. We're talking about, A, some of the best officials that this league has had, right? And notable players, star players, MVP players. When people say, oh, the stars get all the calls, you might want to check. You might want to check with some of these officials to see if they get the calls. And the NBA doesn't want to give off the appearance, J.A., that A, their refs could be biased, like they're not human, you know what I mean? Or B, that a player can single-handedly control what appears to be very random circumstances or random occurrences of, oh, Scott Foster showing up in the building. You know what this means. Like during the playoffs, if Scott Foster's assigned to a game 6, Twitter is saying, oh, it's going to be a game 7. Like you just don't want it to look like that, even if it's for us largely entertainment and funny, because there are clearly circumstances where that does not happen. But just the appearance of it feels a bit swarmy, right?
So what's funny to me is that it seems like there's records, like negative records with every official with every team, right? Like I know the Dallas Mavericks are, you know, very public about their people, and Danny Crawford was one of the guys I know. They seem, but like, okay, if Scott Foster has a bad record with this team, or the team has a bad record with Scott Foster fishing games, and Chris Paul is going against that team, so you're convinced that Scott Foster is going to be against both teams. You know, like sooner or later, the numbers kind of run into each other. Just real quick, I looked up Jake O'Donnell. He had a feud with Clyde Drexler, and the league solution was actually didn't let him work the rest of the playoffs. So it wasn't just, okay, you can't work Trailblazers games, you can't work the rest of the playoffs, which seems highly dramatic. But is that the solution here? That if the Warriors and Chris Paul are in the playoffs, you couldn't have Scott Foster work the playoffs? I mean, I think you're harming the whole playoff process, right? If you're taking one of the higher ranked officials out of the mix entirely just because of the feud with one player.
Well, hey, that was David Stern's America. That's a little bit different. That's a little bit different.
Draconian.
That's a little bit different than Adam Silver's America. Okay. Mind you, David Stern, for all of his nonsense, right? He was the emperor in every way, shape, or form. He was literally laying down the law in all ways, right? It didn't matter. He was
vengeance.
Not run.
Biblical at times. Old Testament.
He said Old Testament, not New Testament. He was the book Old of Genesis, Testament. Okay? So
bloods and stuff.
So one thing David Stern was not party to was this in-season tournament, right, Jay? Now, I was a huge critic of it. I thought it was hokey. I thought it messed with the integrity of the NBA season. With the integrity of 82 games, like you're telling fans that you have a problem as opposed to saying, hey, y'all, we don't really have a problem. The problem is people keep talking about it as if there's a problem. Maybe I'm wrong. But it looks like, J.A., this in-season tournament thing has been a success, at least on one level, where this is sort of giving us a window into what teams could be really good beyond the teams we already know, beyond the Bostons and Denvers and Milwaukees. We're being introduced to Minnesota, and we're being introduced to the Indiana Pacers, and we're being introduced to all these different teams that maybe we wouldn't otherwise have a reason to pay attention to. Now we're getting a chance to pay attention to them a little bit early. Is that how you see it, or is it still, let's see how this all plays out in Vegas next week?
I'm finding that it's just elevating the intensity of the games and it's adding to intrigue. It's funny, I was thinking about this over the weekend, how I'm into the tournament, even though I really don't care who wins the tournament. I've got no rooting interest. And to me, there's no particular compelling storyline. Like, I don't have a team in the NBA, right? Like, as a journalist doing this for 30 years, like, I'm kind of devoid of fandom. But there have been teams that I prefer to see win. And it's funny, one of the teams that I wanted to see win, and we might not have even gotten to the situation where we needed an in-season tournament to juice up interest during the regular season, was I thought it was really important that a 2017 Warriors team finished the job after winning 73 games, because if they didn't, we'd never have teams care about the regular season again, right? What I loved about that team was that they went all in every night during the regular season. They made, you know,
you mean 2016. You mean 2016 Warriors.
2016 team, sorry. Yeah. The 2016 team. They went all in every night because they were pursuing history. And at the point where they had players playing nights that they probably should have been resting for injuries, they were all in. And now we never talk about that team. Why? Because they gave it the 3-1 lead and they've been subjected to endless memes and jokes ever since, right? And I really felt like that was the end of teams caring and trying to do anything special during the regular season. And so I wanted to see that team win specifically so that the regular season would matter in years going forward. And it hasn't mattered since. And now it matters for occasional nights, you know, those Tuesday and Friday nights during November. It's gotten more interesting. And I am more interested because the players are more interested, right? Their interest has made me want to tune in and watch these games. And it's funny. It's like now I look forward like, oh, is it an in-season tournament game? Is the funky court down? Is the bright, you know, retina-singeing court down on? That means it's an extra special game, right? And it's a little bit of a letdown when it's not an in-season tournament game, right? Even though I really don't care who wins. I don't think we're going to be talking years from now about who wins this tournament. But it has made for more compelling, more intense regular season games because the players seem to care.
Well, for one, I'm going to really sound like an old man here. I hate the courts, largely. I largely hate the courts. I really hate the court in Cleveland because it feels like you're on a stage and there was a player, I think from, maybe it's from Miami, and he tore his Achilles Miami. Or ACL, and now he's going to miss the entire year because they can't have the floor on the same level. That's a completely different discussion, but just on the floors itself. Like, some of these things look like a monstrosity, right? There are certain teams, and I said this on, I don't think I said it on Twitter because I'm trying to wean myself off of that monster, but I said it's on Threads. There are certain places that no matter what's going on, the floor should not change. The Knicks floor should not change. The Lakers floor should not change. The Celtics floor should not change. It should be what you can do, whatever you want to do around it and all of that. I'm not a huge fan of a big ass cup in the middle of it, a big ass gold cup in the middle of it. Like Jay, I am a fan of putting the playoff logos on the floor, of putting the finals logo on the floor. You can just keep the big ass cup and trophy off of the floor. We don't need that. But aside from that, I think you see that A, $500,000 is really important to guys. And B, that Adam Silver was right, at least in this form, when he said, you give players a carrot. You say, hey, there's something, there's an added incentive for you to win. There's something for you as a team to win. Teams are going to go for it. And I feel like they are. And the Lakers, it looks like the Lakers have clinched the spot. That's kind of been expected, especially when you look at sort of the division that they're in. Not saying that the league would ever, J.A., make things easier so that the Lakers could go to Las Vegas and we could get more television ratings. I'm not suggesting that at all. But I am saying is that the Lakers have taken this very seriously, along with the Pacers, who are 4-0. And it looks like we're going to get teams that we like and teams that we want to know, which is completely different. Two totally different things, in my opinion. Teams that we want to know, that we're curious about, that we want to see, okay, with elevated stakes, can you rise, can you raise your game? Can you get to a certain level of a quote-unquote championship team if Denver is there, if Boston is there? Like, I do want to see you know, all of those things. And Tuesday, tomorrow, Jay, is the last night of group play. And then, you know, eight teams will advance, four from the East, four from the West, and then one wild card, you know, three in each, and then one wild card, you know, per conference. And Jay, I am going to Vegas, okay? Against my will, I am going to Vegas.
I might head up there voluntarily, actually.
You should come. Why not?
I know you and a couple other people have said, go ahead. So I actually booked a hotel room already. I might pop up there next week. But to your first point about seeing different teams, that's actually something that I thought we got out of the play-in tournament.
Yeah.
Are the play-in games. Mm-hmm. Is it a tournament? I don't even know.
I guess it is a tournament.
At first, I was opposed to that. And, mm-hmm. you know, the first time we had the Lakers versus the Warriors, and people are like, oh, see, you know, and obviously it did big numbers, but I'm thinking, okay, do you really want to use that up for one game when you could have a whole series of that? Do you really want to risk, which was what wound up happening, was that you only got two, quote unquote, postseason games from the Warriors instead of a minimum of four. Like, I don't think that's good for business to put your, you know, your marquee teams like that at risk, and they wound up getting out. But I think the flip side was we had the Grizzlies get in that year by beating the Warriors, and you had a chance for us to see. That was the first time we really got to see some of those teams. And so I think for the long term, you know, probably didn't help ratings that year, but for the long term, it was a good idea. We had no idea that Ja Morant was going to derail that franchise because he couldn't stop waving guns around. But
He couldn't stop waiting with guns around, J.A. Not to cut you off. No, keep your thought. It wasn't that this fool couldn't stop waving guns around. This fool couldn't stop telling us that he was waving guns around. If there is one thing that I hate, and I'm not transitioning to Josh Giddey, although I don't think he should be playing while they quickly adjudicate this. They can easily figure this out. But the only reason that we know about Ja Morant is because Ja Morant told us. The only reason we know about Josh Giddey is because, for those who don't know, Josh Giddey has been accused of engaging in an inappropriate relationship with a minor in Oklahoma, where, and this is where it gets tricky, the age for consent is 16, and apparently the woman in question is over 16 years old. So it maybe feels a certain way. You know, it looks a certain way. But the larger point is, J.A., why do these fools got to tell us everything that they doing? I don't need to know.
Yeah, the social media component of sharing your entire life. Like, you know, what got Josh suspended was a live stream in a car, right? Like, at what point does your drive ever need to be shared with people, right? Do we ever need video of you driving in a car?
Never.
It's never. Not what you're doing is not that exciting. It's not that interesting. But in this case, it wound up costing you 25 games of a season and derailing you. And it's funny. Sometimes the after effect can be more damaging than the actual thing. I've been reminding people that, remember, Gilbert Arenas wasn't initially suspended for bringing guns in the locker room, right? He continued to play while the NBA was investigating.
It was
that. What did bring the hammer, the wrath of David Stern, was when he came out and did finger guns in the intros to another game. The finger guns actually got him suspended. David Stern said, oh, hell no. You ain't coming out here mocking this whole situation.
You gonna play in David Stern's face?
Right. So, you know, again, with Ja Morant, he didn't threaten anyone with a gun, right? You know, I don't think he wasn't shown shooting a gun, no, right? He just pulled it out in a car. That's not necessarily a threat, especially, you know, whatever, depending on the laws of whatever state he was in, right? But it was just the perception of doing this with all that hanging over your head. So you think about how often the NBA is a perception-based league. Mm-hmm. And then given that, once you're kind of under the microscope and heightened scrutiny, and you'd still publicly do this stuff. And again, people need to know their history. People need to know what got Gilbert Arenas suspended. And then you wouldn't be doing some of this nonsense when you've already been facing punishment for more serious offenses.
No, it's funny because there was no social media when Gilbert Arenas was around. And I guarantee you, if there was, Gilbert Arenas probably would have been suspended well before he actually brought Grimes to the locker room. He would have done something.
Did he ever get in trouble with his blog? Because he was kind of OG and at the vanguard because he was blogging. Remember? And I think it raised some eyebrows. I don't think it ever warranted league punishment, right? But he was kind of already living on the edge with his blog.
Yeah, he was living on the edge with the blog. He was, and I don't want people to get the perception that we don't like characters. Because the NBA, like, I love characters in the NBA. I think that's partially why I hate that coaches don't wear suits and they don't dress up like adults anymore. Like, you could see personality in how a coach dresses. You can see personality in all these different ways. And I feel like, J.A., we got so many different avenues for players to show their personality, and these dudes are boring. Unless you're Ja Morant in a Denver club at Shotgun Willie's at 5 in the morning, and you pull out your little baby Harlem Knights gun that was the size of Della Reese's pinky toe. All right, what you gonna do with that little bitty ass gun, for one, right? Jay, think about this. The Washington Post had a full-ass story on Ja Morant beating up a kid in his backyard, going to Finish Line and acting a plum fool. Not just him, not just his crew, but his mama. Okay, whole thing that didn't prompt a whole league investigation. But this fool going out here on Instagram and telling us, pulling out his gun, not once. In the instance you were talking about, that was the second instance where his buddy Devontae Pack was out here showing on Instagram Live. Fool, don't y'all realize that y'all are being watched? Josh Giddey, don't you think just because you're in Oklahoma City and you don't think anybody pays attention, don't think that the Twitter detectives won't find you. Like, that's the great thing about the NBA, JA, is that you don't have to be in a certain market to receive exposure, but you also don't have to be in a certain market to be exposed.
Also crazy to think, who's a player on the Miami Heat that got suspended, basically, or I guess technically wasn't suspended. He was just kind of quietly let go, right, for the anti-Semitic slur while he was playing video
Myers,
games,
Myers
right?
Leonard. Yeah,
Myers Leonard, right. You know, and so he just, you know, lets a slur slip while he's playing video games. And I mean, you just have to wonder how many people were watching that live, right? And do people go on, do they record that just in case somebody says something crazy?
I think that's what it is.
How many times is like Kevin Durant, not that he said anything that really got him in trouble, but like just, you know, on Twitter spaces or something, you know, right, going on, or Clubhouse or these things, right? Like, no matter how many people are out there, that's why one of my fundamental rules is, you know, never hit send on anything, never say anything over the internet unless you're prepared to share it with the entire world. Right. You might think it's a private DM. You might think it's an encrypted, you know, message that's only being sent to one person. Never say or send anything that you're not prepared to share with the entire world and to deal with the consequences.
And if they haven't learned that yet, they're going to learn. They're going to figure this out. They're going to really figure this out. But as if you're watching on YouTube, you can see J.A. is wearing purple. That is not Forum Gold. That is not Forum Blue.
Forum Blue.
That is Northwestern Blue. But J.A. is an LA guy. He covered the Lakers from, you know, from the Shaq and Kobe heights of, you know, who hates
pretty
who
much during the whole Kobe era. You know, I got back out to LA his second year, and I was there through his last game. I you know what's funny, I'm not sure how many people can say they're in the building for his first point and his last point, because his first point was a free throw scored at Madison Square Garden, which I was working at the Washington Post, but I took the train up, and that was his first game, Kobe and Shaq's first game with the Lakers in the Garden. So I was there, 1 point, one free throw, that was it. And then I was there in LA for his last game in 2016. So not a lot of people, but I didn't cover his first season, but I was there for his first point.
Right. No, that's a 20-year thing. His first game was, I'm sure, was in November of 96, and his last game was in April of 2016, the same night, as we go full circle, the same night that the Warriors won their 73rd game. And one of those games was on ESPN, too. Like, I can't remember which game was on the secondary network. I feel like the Warriors going for 73 was on ESPN, too. This just shows you how crazy things were around that time. But this iteration of the Lakers, Jay, I have a hard time figuring them out. Like, they're 10-7. They've had a lot of home games. Every year, and this is not Laker-centric, but every year, J.A., there's a new LeBron initiative, right? Someone, LeBron's going to play more defense, or LeBron's going to take his foot off the throttle, or we're going to have more playmakers around LeBron so he doesn't have to have the same amount of responsibility. And this year, it is LeBron's not going to play as many minutes. We're going to keep his minutes down. Well, LeBron's leading the team in scoring, leading the team in assists, second in rebounding, playing 34 minutes a game. That whole passing the team to Anthony Davis thing ain't quite happened, right? Like, how long can they keep doing this, or how long can he keep doing this? Because as we've seen, J.A., whenever LeBron pushes it too hard too soon, there is a price to be paid on the back end.
Yeah, and last year, you know, he really wanted to get that record, the scoring record at home. You know, it kind of all pointed to that one night, and he really went all out. And then, like, but like, we didn't see him for a couple of weeks after that.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like,
we saw him at a suite at the Super Bowl, but we didn't see him on the court that much right afterward, right? You know, we do have to be conscious and cognizant. And it's just, I think it's alarming for the Lakers how LeBron dependent they are at this point. But really, I kind of gave up on the Anthony Davis takeover really in the bubble, because as they started their first couple rounds of the playoffs, they actually did go as Anthony Davis went. Like, if you looked at his plus minus, you know, it was better with him than it was for LeBron. And then they got to the finals and LeBron was like, all right, I got this. I'll take it from here.
Yep.
And he thought that maybe would have been a temporary thing, but no, that turned out to be the template for them going forward. And we've had moments, right? Like Anthony Davis, I thought was the difference against the Warriors. You know, that was a really good matchup for him in the playoffs mm-hmm. last year. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, he really dominated at least the early games. I think LeBron was the one that kind of closed out the Warriors in that series. But then against Denver, it just wasn't happening. Right. You know,
nobody has anything for that Joker. Let's just say that.
No. And I think in a lot of ways, the story of the season is really open and shut. You know, if Denver is intact going into the playoffs, I think it's theirs. It's kind of interesting too. They don't seem to be too invested in the in-season tournament when we look at that. Like, so I don't know how much the in-season tournament is going to tell us. It is interesting that LeBron does seem in, yes. And that he's carrying them. You know, if they win it all, LeBron's going to be the one to carry them. And I know coming off this weekend, Anthony Davis just had a really great game, you know, kind of showcase what he can do. But they've been too few and far between. And I just don't think it's sustainable. You know, I thought the model for them was going to be Anthony Davis would have to take over. And I thought the reason why this pairing would work was that LeBron had gone to one of the few places and joined one of the few players who was capable of being a number one ahead of him.
Right.
You know, even at this stage in his career, there aren't a lot of players that you put him on the team with LeBron and they're going to be ahead of LeBron in the pecking order. And I thought Anthony Davis would be that guy, but he hasn't been that guy. You know, sometimes it's necessary. Like, I thought with the Blake Griffin, Chris Paul Lakers, I thought in order for them to advance, Blake Griffin would have to become the best player on that team.
Right.
Like, I always say that you can only go so far when the best player in the team is my height. Chris Paul ain't that much taller than me. It's hard to win a championship with guys my height as your best player, about 6 feet tall. Blake Griffin could never become that number one guy.
Right.
And I just don't think Anthony Davis will, as long as LeBron plays, if LeBron's 44, it's hard for me to imagine Anthony Davis becoming a better player, the best player on that team ahead of LeBron.
Well, A, you said a mouthful there. To the Chris Paul thing, that is why Isaiah Thomas will forever be criminally underrated, because he is no taller than Chris Paul. He is barely taller than me, and he engineered two championships and probably should have gotten a third if not for Hugh Hollins and his wayward whistle, as we were talking about officiating earlier. But Jay, you said the thing about AD, and I go both sides on AD. And here's why. For one, AD was the MVP of the first two games of that 2020 final series. And that man did not get a good look the rest of the way. Okay. That was so obvious.
Do you think that was him shrinking, or do you think that was LeBron saying, I got this?
Yes. That's what I'll say. I'll say, yeah. But do I think it was more the latter? Absolutely. When LeBron comes out and says, I want my damn respect, that lets you know that clearly what he was thinking about for the last three games of that final series. Never mind that Jimmy Butler had 2 30-point triple doubles on his watch, but we're going to leave that alone. Okay. All right, cool. But for AD, and this is the whole thing about the Lakers to me that's really interesting. I agree with you that he's not taking the mantle. The other side of that is it's really hard to play both sides of the floor at a super high level. Joel Embiid isn't even the defender that Anthony Davis is. And he can score 30 points a night because they're not asking him to protect the rim, even though he is the rim protector. They've shaded their defense in such a way that hardly anybody gets there. With the Lakers, it's like, yeah, go ahead and walk down this primrose path. We get Anthony Davis there waiting on you. I think it's really hard in today's game. I think it's really hard, period. And you can only think of maybe a couple of players, maybe Tim Duncan being one and Hakeem Olajuwon during a very short period of time, right? Where you were a true anchor of the defense and you were carrying the offense. You were the hub of the offense. And even Anthony Davis playing the best defense of his life in the Western Conference Finals last year. Couldn't get a game off of Nikola Jokic. Couldn't get a game. And you're playing the best, most consistent, most concentrated. Like he used so much game plan discipline with Jokic in that series. It had to be demoralizing for him to watch basically Jokic put a clown suit on him for four straight games. And I just think it's hard. I wonder, J.A., if big men can anchor a team on both ends of the floor in today's game and win a championship.
It is hard, in addition, when you look at the way the Lakers are constructed, right? Because Tim Duncan had Bruce Bowen, an excellent perimeter defender, you know, to handle the guards or to at least slow them down. And the Lakers don't have a Bruce Bowen out there guarding on the perimeter. And it's actually affecting, I was watching one of the Laker games over the weekend, it's really affecting Anthony Davidson, causing him to get out of position. So he can't be the defender he wants to be or is capable of being because he has to do so much to cover up and to help out on other players, perimeter players who are getting beat, and is bringing him out of position. So I think his block shots have been down recently, but it's not, I would say, a result of him. If you watch the games, it's him having to do so much to compensate for the deficiencies of his teammates that he's not putting up the production. He's not being the defender that he can be. So, Vinny, in addition to him just having to play both roles, to be expected to produce offensively and defensively in a way that maybe we're not asking of anyone else in the league, right? He's having to do extra stuff to compensate for those who aren't doing their jobs.
Yeah, and it's funny because we think of the Lakers franchise, and we think of all the championship big men. You think of Shaq, you think of Kareem. And Kareem, those championships that he got with the Lakers, those largely were on the back of Magic Johnson, right? Like Kareem was starting the decline. He was still very, very effective, I would say, up until 86. Like 85 was kind of Kareem's last hurrah as a bus driver, so to speak, right, as the guy who could be the best player on the championship team. That was the redemption series from 84, where, you know, everybody right in the Lakers had to acquit themselves better in 85, and Kareem carried that team at 38 years old. That's an amazing thing, regardless of anything that LeBron does, right? Or anything anybody else
Finals
does.
Finals MVP at 38.
Finals MVP at 38, right? And then he plays, you know, four more years and wins two more championships, you know, largely on the back of Magic Johnson and him being a support player as opposed to a guy that things revolve around. Even Shaquille O'Neal, that first year that Phil Jackson was there, that was the best version of Shaq on both ends of the floor we've ever seen. The next year, that playoff run might have been the best version of Shaq or best version of any player we've ever seen in modern NBA basketball. And that includes LeBron, that includes Mike, because 7 feet beats anything else you got. 7'1", 330 beats anything you got. But it's also
the best version of Kobe simultaneously.
That's a great
point. And unreal performance by Derek Fisher, who just couldn't miss from three in the conference finals. So, like, all those things coming together, You're right. That's probably the best playoff run that we'll ever see.
Now to the Lakers, because I'm going to bring this from an Anthony Davis standpoint and from a LeBron standpoint and from an Austin Reeves standpoint. Austin Reeves was the surprise last year. And he got paid, he played USA basketball. You know, is he dating Taylor Swift and all that stuff? You know, that type of stuff, right? How hard is it to play in Los Angeles, both as a role player who people are expecting a lot from and as a star player? Like, we think of pressure as far as playing in New York because it feels like our friend Bomani Jones has been saying, it feels like 20,000 people in Madison Square Garden got money on the game. That's how much pressure it is playing in New York. In L.A., it doesn't feel like it because there's so much other stuff to do. But there's an inordinate amount of pressure playing for the Lakers, both as a star and a role player, right?
It is, but it's also the rewards are so much higher, right? Like, you know, you can be an Austin Reeves. Like, more people have heard of Austin Reeves than probably are warranted. More people have heard of Alex Caruso than warranted. And, you know, not to say that they're not, you know, outstanding players, but, you know, they're placed in the league hierarchy. You know, they're above some people. You know, we probably talk about Austin Reeves more than we do like Tyrese Halliburton, right?
Yes.
So, you know, there's the rewards that come with it, outsized rewards. You know, what's interesting about the Lakers construction is that I noticed they have the only pair of players in the top 10 in the league in per, you know, the player efficiency rating. You know, and to the extent that that's the be all end all stat, you know, I don't necessarily do that. But to me, sometimes it's an interesting reference point. You know, Jokic is leading not that far above Embiid, but the fact that LeBron is eighth, Anthony Davis is ninth, and yet the Lakers aren't like head and shoulders above everyone, right? So like the old construction, you know, to me going predating, you know, the Miami Heat era. You know, you all from the 80s on, you needed to have two Hall of Famers in or around their prime in order to have a shot at the championship. Look at every champion, you know, going through the 80s, especially. But, you know, that continued through the 90s and, you know, Kobe and Shaq and you name it. Right. The Lakers, you could argue, have that at least statistically more than anyone right now. And yet they're still
they don't
not
feel like a championship team.
Right. They don't feel like. You know, this is the components of a championship team. You know, in the Sixers, you've got Embiid. Maxey, does he feel like a Hall of Fame player? Not necessarily. You know, Denver, Jokic, is Jamal Murray a Hall of Fame player? Not necessarily. Maybe he can play like one at times.
Right.
You know, like when the last time the Warriors won, Curry, Hall of Famer, Andrew Wiggins played like a Hall of Famer that postseason, right? So I guess if you can't have two Hall of Famers, at least have two people playing at a Hall of Fame level temporarily.
Or just one supernova, not just Hall of Famer. Like Steph played like a supernova in that 2022 final series. That game four.
But they're still not winning if Wiggins isn't playing at that level.
True.
Right?
Like, no, just support. It was support.
Rarely seen one. Like, you need two guys. Akeem kind of did it by himself, you know, way back in 95 and 94.
95, he had Clyde Drexler.
Yeah. Yeah, but Clyde wasn't playing like a Hall of Famer at that time, though.
Right.
So you just wonder, you know, people are talking about the super team era is over, but I just wonder even if that paradigm is over, because kind of looking at it, the Lakers should be the best team having those two guys playing at that level. Even if Anthony Davis isn't playing at the level we'd like, if he's still a top 10 guy statistically, you know, by that measure at least, then they should be right there, right? But it's, you know, the depth has become critical, right? You know, if not to carry through the regular season, but also just in case something happens in the postseason. You're not going to get through the postseason with everyone healthy, with their people getting suspended for a game or something, right?
Right.
Which kind of is why I just can't buy into Phoenix. You know, as strong as they can look at times, as well as KD is playing this stage of his career. You know, we talk about LeBron doing it this late. Mm-hmm. KD's getting up there too now.
Yes,
he only came
to
the league a couple years after LeBron, and he's still performing at a high, high level.
Mm-hmm.
Can they get through without one of those guys being hurt? And then is the model now back to big men too? I think that's the thing we have to work, you know, like, is it, that's, you have to have somebody that can counter Jokic. The Warriors got away with a long time without having a true dominant big man center, you know, for their era. Like, I wonder if those, how those Warriors would fare against these Nuggets.
Well, I think their math, and the Warriors just flipped the math, right? They said 3 beats 2. And we're going to be better at defending you than you will be at trying to mimic us. And I think that's what happened there, where, oh, the Warriors are shooting threes. We have to shoot threes, but you don't have Steph, Clay, and then later Kevin Durant. Like, you don't have those guys that can do that, on top of Kevin Durant arguably being the most impactful defensive player in the league at that time, right? Which I think elevated him past LeBron as an individual player in the league. We just don't have the gumption to actually say that out loud, because LeBron, you know, literally pulled the Vince Young stealing the Heisman from USC, you know, in the Rose Bowl. Like, he did, like, LeBron did that in 2016. So nobody's going to fix their mouths to say that again. But the big man thing, I think people were saying this, J.A., and I thought it was really foolish of them to say. They're like, well, nobody went and got a Jokic stopper this offseason. Where that dude at?
Right.
Who's a Jokic stopper? So I wouldn't try, if I was building a team that would, that knows that they're going to have to face Denver, be it Phoenix, be it L.A., would I try to get someone that could take pressure off of an Anthony Davis having to defend Jokic for 40 minutes a night? Yes, because I'd want Anthony Davis to be the best help defender in the game, right? Okay. But short of that, there's no dude out here that can defend Jokic. Remember, we tried to fool ourselves and say Rui Hachimura because he had like 3 good minutes against Jokic in game one of the Western Finals. Oh, we've got the Jokic stopper now. Yeah, that didn't go well. So if I'm a team executive, Jay, I'm not trying to get somebody who can defend Jokic. I'm trying to do everything I can to stress Jokic out defensively and try to wear him down so that maybe he's not as effective later in games. And if that means
to put him in pick and rolls.
Yeah, you right. got to.
So what's interesting, though, is that with the more restrictive salary cap and luxury tax regulations, you can't build a more flexible roster. Mm-hmm. So I remember the Oklahoma City Thunder when they had Kendrick Perkins on the roster, and all of, especially all the analytics was like, oh, you know, look at his efficiency numbers and blah, blah, blah. And they're, you know, plus minus when he's on. Well, they had him on the roster in case they went up against the Lakers, who at the time still had Pau Gasol and Drew Bynum. So you had to be prepared if, you know, if you were going to beat the Lakers, you know, coming off those 2009-10 back-to-back championships, you know, they wanted to construct a roster to be competitive with them if they had to, in addition right. to being competitive, you know, with, I don't know, the remnants of the Suns, or, you know, it's kind of, you know, the league was moving toward that more right. faster pace, right. but you still had the Lakers, who were a really big team at the time. And so you had to be able to play both. Now, do you build your roster to beat Denver and Jokic? Do you build it to beat the array of perimeter talent that the Suns have? Are you trying to beat what the Clippers had, you know? So, but I mean, we've seen that, like, the Clippers went up against Denver and they were hurt because they didn't have a big man that could effectively counter Jokic. And by counter, you're right, Benny, it doesn't necessarily always have to be defensively guard him. Can you counter by presenting a threat at the center position that Jokic has to guard? So we're asking teams to now, this Denver equation, you could argue that the in East Philadelphia with Embiid, right? Or even Milwaukee with Giannis, like, you need to be able to have bigs, but the league is so 3-point heavy too. You need guys who can either, you know, it's make the threes it's an or defend the threes.
He's an unsolvable conundrum. Literally, he is. Jokic is I don't know where he ranks as far as if you put him in the pantheon with Kareem and Hakeem and Shaq at his best and Dave. I don't know where he belongs there. All I know is that right now he feels like the most inevitable thing happening in the league in a way that I have not felt inevitable in a long time. Like,
since Shaq?
This is what I'm saying, since Shaq. But even Shaq hit the kryptonite of maybe you get Shaq in foul trouble. Maybe Shaq right. isn't interested.
Or you send him to the line for free throws, right?
You
send, you know, that never
line.
Worked.
I make them when they count. I make them when they count.
You know, I always said, like, okay, if it was that easy, you know, if free throws were that important, then how did Shaq wind up with four rings? You know, so it didn't work. But you're right. He doesn't have that. What is the weakness? You know, what do you force him to do other than, you're right, maybe go at him?
I think you have to. I think
who's equipped to do that?
my general thought is, and this was Michael in his prime, or Michael pre-championship prime, like Detroit went at him, not like physically, oh, we're going to beat you up, but you had Dumars
and beat him up. That was the Jordan rules. Beat him up.
Whatever. It's all fabricated, right? All fabricated. We don't have any videos on that. But but like with Magic, make Magic work on defense. With Michael, make Michael work on defense. Same thing with LeBron. Make LeBron work. That was Andre Iguodala. That was Kawhi Leonard. That was putting all of these guys in stressful situations. You don't avoid them. Like, you're not stupid about it, but you don't avoid them. You go at them so that they don't have enough energy down on the other end of the court to be the best versions of themselves. And I think for Denver to win a title, Jokic has to be the best possible version of himself, because there is no second star. You know what I mean? And if he's 90%, which is still a Hall of Fame player, 90% of Jokic, you got a chance. 100% of Jokic, you got no shot. That's what I think, Jay.
So, you know, it's funny, going back, that was part of the secret of the success of the Warriors too, was that Curry didn't have to guard, you know, at a time when there were a lot of great point guards in the league, Westbrook, Chris Paul, et cetera. You know, you could have Klay Thompson guard them, right? Or you could bring in Sean Livingston and have them guard them. So, like, Curry didn't have to expend a lot of energy on the defensive end, which left him free to expend a lot of energy and run all around on the offensive end, and lost those threes from half court. So you kind of retroactively look at that. I mean, that's one thing that hasn't changed about the league, right? Is that sometimes the best defense is a good offense, or vice versa. But it's just interesting that we got to this place, though, that so many teams replicated what the Warriors were doing, that, you know, they no longer have this just inherent advantage where they're just going to hit you with a barrage of threes and the math is going to catch up with you, because now the Warriors are a very average team when it comes to making three, or even below average, right?
Yeah.
So many people can beat them at their own game. Real quick, since you insist on talking about the 80s Pistons, you know, Sid Kropf passed away from Sid and Marty Kropf, who made these 70s shows. That those of us who grew up watching Saturday morning TV will forever remember. But part of that has to do with one of your beloved Pistons. Bill Laimbeer was a sleestack on Land of the Lost, which resurfaced over the weekend when Sid Kropf passed away. So the sleestacks were these kind of, they look like the creature from the Black Lagoon or whatever, you know, kind of like these like amphibious type creatures. They moved really slow. They made this weird noise.
Yeah.
And so apparently in a few episodes one year, Bill Laimbeer was one of the guys in the costumes back when he was in high school in his 1970s. He was still tall back then, you know, before he was known as Bill Laimbeer. Maybe his jumper wasn't what it would become later, but he was still tall. So Bill Laimbeer was a sleestack. And I thought that was something funny, a moment of the Bad Boy Pistons that kind of was brought back to light this weekend as people mourned the passing of Sid Kropf. And it just prompted like this branch of NBA social media to start, hey, remember the time Bill Laimbeer played a sleestack on Land of the Lost?
I didn't see that. I must not have been on social.
Missed that part? Yeah. Go back and look. I don't know. You probably don't remember. Was that a part of your childhood?
That was not a part of my childhood.
HR Puff and stuff and that.
J.A., I was born in 1984. My birthday.
So for Gen Xers like myself, you know, Sid and Marty Kropf, rest in peace, Sid Kropf. But shout out to Bill Laimbeer for playing a sleestack. That's like the most interesting. That's the most likable thing I've ever found about Bill Laimbeer, was that he was a sleestack once.
Okay, let me think about that. What's the most likable
thing? What else is likable about Bill Laimbeer? You're struggling.
I am struggling. Okay. Likeable.
Likeable.
I don't think that Bill Laimbeer is as loathsome as our colleague and our good friend Michael Wilbon likes to call him. Bill Laimbeer is loathsome. Dude, you rooted for Bill Cartwright. I cannot. Okay. You rooted for Jerry Curled AC Green back in the day, who was also kind of
lonesome about it. You can't mention the pristine AC Green.
Yeah, pristine and one, only pristine in one way. Okay. If you know, you know. Only pristine and untouched in one way. Bill Laimbeer, though, quietly should be a Hall of Famer. If you go look at the numbers, Bill Laimbeer should be in Hall of Famer, but he's not because he's Bill Laimbeer. And that just probably won't ever change. But that, ladies and gentlemen, is my man J.A. Adande. Of course, J.A. leading the entire sports journalism department at Northwestern School of Medill. J.A., of course, appreciate you, man. Thanks again. I'm going to have you on again. You're part of the Good Word family, so to speak. You're in the circle of trust.
You got to wear your purple hoodie next time so we can match.
I will wear my purple hoodie next time. So as long as people don't think that it's Lakers purple, right? Then we good. I'll make sure it says Northwestern School of Medill across the front. But
there you go. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me. And maybe I'll see you in Vegas.
Hey, look, unfortunately, you will see me in Vegas. I will be there against my will. That is one of the least places on earth I ever want to be, but I'll go and, you know, we'll have a cocktail or two, shall we say. That is J.A. Adande. Go find him on social media at J.A. Adande, wherever you get your social media nowadays. There you go. What was that again?
J.A. Adande. Just the J, not J.A.
J.A.
Adande. A-D-A-N-D-E.
There you go. At J. Adande. Thanks to producer John working behind the glass, Evan and Ron, of course, putting together the videos for us. Dan Devine will be back this week for another episode of Divine Intervention tomorrow. I will be back for a solo episode of The Good Word on Wednesday. Until then, everybody, be safe.